and my sign says Vivas nos queremos, ni una menos. This was the slogan of a big campaign that started last year in Latin America because of hola, how do you say hola? Because of a wave of feminicides and crimes against women that were sadly pretty much veiled by the states that didn't do anything to fight them. So it's something that started in Peru, went through Argentina, Mexico, and many other Latin American countries. And we also feel that from here, women that are immigrants, that are living here in the states, sadly, we don't feel that that situation changes at all. So it's just a wake-up call, no? It's ni una menos, because we don't want more victims of gender violence.
That's voices from A Day Without a Woman rally in Washington Square Park in the Village in New York City. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear more voices from the protest. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is a forest defense organization that has been successfully defending eastern Oregon forests for the last 25 years against ecological destruction. This benefit features music by A Stick, A Stone, Cinder Well, and Johanna Warren, as well as humor, storytelling, and more. Again, that's the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the premiere screening of Precipice Award-funded animation project Jen Likes Heroin on Thursday, March 9th at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Jen Likes Heroin is an animated short film which takes place at the long-defunct X-Ray Cafe. Following the animation, there will be a showing of the documentary about the X-Ray Cafe called X-Ray Visions and a short acoustic set by Sean Krogan of The Pinnacles and Cracker Bash. Again, that's a screening of X-Ray Visions and Jen Likes Heroin and a live performance by Sean Krogan on Thursday, March 9th at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, residents of the Clifford Apartments in southeast Portland are organizing to protect their rights as tenants.
Hillsboro is the latest Oregon city to declare itself a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants.
And we'll take a look back at a protest outside of ICE headquarters in Portland on Monday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 9th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Tenants at the Clifford Apartments in southeast Portland are trying to organize. They say the management company, Income Property Management, has unfairly retaliated against tenants who have made complaints regarding health and safety. KBOO's Yenka Soderberg has more.
Low-income tenants across the city of Portland have often borne the brunt of landlords and management companies' practices. At apartment buildings like the Clifford in Southeast Portland, tenants have complained of unsafe conditions for the families with children who live there, including smoking, illicit drug use, and prostitution in the building. The Clifford has gone through numerous changes in management and underwent a major renovation in 2010 to try to clean it up. It's now owned by the nonprofit Innovative Housing Incorporated and managed by Income Property Management. People who live at the apartment building are low income and have to qualify in order to get a place there. Virtually every low-income apartment complex in the city of Portland has a long waiting list. People in the street have reported having to wait years sometimes to get one of the coveted rooms and apartments available for low-income tenants. This makes it difficult for tenants who feel their rights are violated to speak out or stand up for fear of retaliation or of potentially losing their home. Several tenants at the Clifford did speak with me on condition of anonymity about deferred maintenance, health and safety violations in the building, female tenants being intimidated and harassed by aggressive male tenants without consequence, and retaliation against those who spoke out. Here are the voices of those tenants.
The manager ignored all the maintenance requests. She said she'd do them. She blamed the guy that does maintenance when I told the management above her.
What kind of maintenance requests?
My ceiling fan, the cord broke, so it's just been going nonstop since like mid-December. My window, just different. There was a leak, water from the roof.
And so that ceiling fan issue has probably made it pretty cold.
Yeah. She also said she'd get the dust off the pipes the first day, and she never did. They won't get him a ladder, and then she was, like, blaming him for not going to ladder training when she... But she just ignored me on the whole thing.
And you submitted a maintenance request the way that...
she said she'd do it, and she acted like she was going to take care of it, and then she just wouldn't ignored me.
And then you have felt repercussions. You said that there has been some sort of violation by the management against you, that they have tried to...
Another resident was talking to one of them about some hypocrisy, and I joined that conversation, and they gave me a violation for that. And then they chose another violation, and then they said that I needed this thing for bed bugs that I didn't need, just to harass me.
They're targeting people that are trying to enforce, get them to enforce certain laws. Like, there's a new policy in the building that there's no smoking, Indoor Clean Air Act. It's around Oregon, and certain tenants are trying to push them to enforce this law because, like, in the building, it's been active for like 4 months now, and they have not been enforcing the law. And it's like it's no law in effect at that building. They're smoking, tenants are doing whatever they want, and the tenants that complain about it, the management will write them up a notification that they might be evicted or whatever. So what they're doing is trying to get the tenants that want to enforce laws and clean up the building, they want to get them out but keep the people that's bad acting and smoking and doing drugs in there. And that's crazy. Like, what is these people thinking? Like, politicians help keep this building running. Your tax money is helping to keep this building running. And these people want to keep people out that wants to enforce the laws and respect your tax money. The management. But yes, I'm already seeing retaliation from them. I've made several complaints, and I even went to the mayor's office, and he's backing me up. Home Forward is backing me up.
Do you feel like they're targeting certain people who are vocal?
They are already retaliating on me, trying to figure out a way. Let's see how we could get him out of there, because we don't want to do no more work. We don't want to do work. They're just like the company that was next door to them, Safety Net, that was stealing these disabled people's money. And it's this. I think it's the same branch of people, business, that's upholding this building and Safety Net. They shut that building down because it was a big investigation about them stealing money, and they found out, and all those people are in jail now. And these people are a branch off of the same people, and they are low-key. All they want is the tenants' money. The tenants can smoke, do drugs, or whatever they want in the building. They just want the money. And anybody complaining about it, we're going to just give them a notice and kick them out. That's what the situation is here.
After hearing from tenants at the Clifford Apartments in Southeast Portland, I reached out to the management company, Income Property Management, based in downtown Portland. They refused to be on record for this story, but said their 6 staff on site are following all applicable laws and they're not aware of any problems. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
What if they came in here and were rowdy?
Welcome.
A group in Lincoln County, Oregon, has put a measure on the May ballot that would ban aerial spraying of pesticides and herbicides. Lincoln County Community Rights wrote the measure 2177, which also includes language reinforcing the rights of the community, that is, Lincoln County residents, as opposed to corporations. A number of measures in recent years have sought some sort of action against pesticides and herbicides and genetically modified organisms at the county and city levels in Oregon. All of them have been countered by vast, sometimes record-breaking amounts of out-of-state money from multinational corporations like Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, and ConAgra, as well as local and state farm and forestry groups. For more on the measure, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Rio Davidson, one of the organizers who helped get the measure on the ballot. Opponents of this measure did not respond to interview requests in time for the broadcast.
This initiative has gone through a couple of stages.
So, we are in the final stages, but we went through the Citizens Initiative, which we think is a really powerful way to make local laws, and so we did have to gather signatures, and once all the signatures were gathered, we were challenged in court. They actually challenged the county because the county approved our measure to collect signatures. So I guess I messed that up. So first we got challenged, so we submitted the ordinance, and then we were faced with a legal challenge that actually took us about a year to settle. And we had to intervene on the side of the county then, because they had thought that all our ordinance met all the requirements for a Citizens Initiative. So once that challenge was won by our lawyer and the county, then we move forward with the Citizens Initiative petition gathering, or as far as gathering the signatures. So then we gathered 1,600 signatures. Once those were verified, then we were put on the May 2017 ballot.
Were there any particular events that prompted people in Lincoln County to want to ban aerial spraying?
You know, unfortunately, it's such a long history of events. You know, I actually grew up in the Five Rivers area of Oregon, so it's out by Alsea, and okay. That's where, I don't know if you've heard of the book Bitter Fog, but, you know, basically after Vietnam, they started spraying Agent Orange all around the citizens there, and, you know, they took them to federal court, and they won. And since then, they've banned spraying of aerial pesticide or aerial spraying of pesticides on federal land, at least still in the Siusla, and because it is dangerous. And so since then, you know, there's been so many stories of people, either with birth defects, miscarriages, you know, cancer clusters. I mean, the list goes on. And then, you know, what's really shocking to us is that they're actually clear-cutting around our watershed, you know, and so that was one of the main drivers of our group, is to protect our water. You know, we feel like that's the most important thing that our community has, and unfortunately, the, you know, mostly private timber holders, unfortunately out-of-state large corporations, mostly funded by Wall Street, they really have shown little respect to our watersheds, and so that was really what drove us.
Speaking of large out-of-state corporations, a lot of not necessarily similar measures to this, but measures like, for example, the GMO bans in or attempts in Jackson, Josephine, and Benton counties in past years have attracted millions of dollars in out-of-state money. Do you expect that to happen in this ballot measure fight?
You know, we are really, as a local group of citizens, we're doing bake sales and fundraisers, and trying to get our word out, because we know that, unfortunately, like in the past, that, you know, what the citizens want normally gets overrun by the messaging of these large corporations. So, you know, we've been watching the pack of the opposition, and, you know, they've gotten about $20,000 worth of donations in this last month. So we're definitely, you know, we're preparing a grassroots campaign. You know, we really feel like our advantage is that we are local, and we speak for the people here. So, yes, we are, you know, we are aware that these other campaigns saw a significant amount of funding come in, that, and it's really hard to get your message out. I mean, if you think about even the GMO labeling bill, where, you know, the tide was turned by so much money. But the reality is, as a community, it's time that we stand together, and it's time that we decide what we want for our communities. And that's what this is really about, is the community standing up and saying, you know, we're not going to be the ones that are one subsidizing you to clear cut our forests and then spray chemicals that are then harming both our children, wildlife, and watersheds.
And that brings up an interesting point, I think, about this measure that maybe wasn't present, or at least wasn't as prominent in some of the GMO measures in Jackson and Josephine counties, et cetera, community rights angle. Can you just elucidate that briefly for us?
Sure. The community rights, there, it's actually the ORCRN. It's a group of six counties here in Oregon. You know, we're supported by Lincoln County Community Rights. And what these groups are about is looking at environmental issues and also workers' rights in a different way. It's all about looking at how they're violating our rights under our own constitution. You know, our measure is basically based on our Oregon constitution. And so it creates a whole different argument that the opposition is going to have to make if the ballot does pass. Because what it does is it makes it so that they actually have to come to our county courts and argue that they have more constitutional rights here than we do. So it's definitely an exciting time, and it's a really great way to move things forward as far as the way our traditional laws are made. And a lot of this work is actually looking at, you know, our current status of law and looking at where we need to be in the future.
Rio Davidson, I'll let you go for now. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Hey, thanks, Sam. I really appreciate it.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. I've been speaking with Rio Davidson in Lincoln County. He's with a group in that county that is working to ban aerial herbicides and pesticides.
A research team at Oregon Health and Science University's Primate Center in Beaverton conducted a study of the Zika virus, which has caused big outbreaks in South America and Southeast Asia. And more than 5,000 people have been infected here in the United States, including 50 in the state of Oregon. The virus usually causes mild symptoms in adults, but it can shrink the brain of a fetus. In severe cases, children can end up with lifelong problems, including seizures, developmental delays, hearing, and vision loss. The team has federal funding to study various approaches to a vaccine. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health hope to fast-track a drug over a 2-year period in a process that normally takes as long as an entire decade.
Hillsborough Mayor Steve Calloway broke a 3-3 tie in city council today to approve a sanctuary resolution for that city. Activists had rallied twice in front of City Hall demanding the resolution, but were concerned since nearby Forest Grove had rejected a similar bill in January. Mayor Calloway, a retired elementary school principal, said, "This is a day to say to children who have grown up and done the right things and gone to school and worked hard that we do support you." Since President Trump signed an executive order threatening to withhold dollars from sanctuary cities, Hillsborough officials are aware they could lose some federal funding.
During Wednesday's Portland City Council meeting, items number 222 and 231 ran well beyond their time allotment as members of the public spoke out about racist subtext underlying the city's conversation surrounding graffiti abatement and public behavioral conduct in city council meetings. Here is an assortment of the discussion featured in yesterday's meeting.
I just want to say that in a lot of people's minds, once upon a time, graffiti was art. And what we're seeing right now is not art. It's vulgar, hateful, destructive activity. And unfortunately, Jan Valentine, as Stan mentioned, worked for years to coordinate the efforts of the graffiti investigation and abatement and task force work that's been going on in Portland for a number of years. And when the investigation unit was pretty much disbanded, and I don't know if it's for lack of funds, you know, funding, or if it was just because lack of staff, but overnight, things changed dramatically. And again, the nature of what we're seeing is, this is not art. And I just want to encourage the city council to really take this seriously. It's a small amount of money. Granted, there are a lot of issues bigger than graffiti that we're dealing with in our society. And one thing I would like to say is that maybe one of the things we could think about is, do we need, quote, police officers in the investigation unit? You know, do you need a registered nurse to change a baby's diaper in the pediatric unit? No. So let's look at taking the appropriate resources and applying them to that. Let's not literally throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's put the effort that, you know, it's sad to see all this work just go away overnight when we had such a great program going. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Mimi Gurman. This talk is repulsive. I find that this is really all based in race. It's a race attack. It's an attack against the black community, which is usually referred to as whenever gang is used. We know who people mean when the city uses the term gang. What I'd like to know from the people who are asking for $2 million is, how do they know this is gang graffiti? We do know what hate graffiti looks like. Mm-hmm. We know exactly what that looks like. There's nothing ambiguous about it. Gang graffiti. What the hell is that? Who defines that? When's the last time that was defined? I'd like to know what the definition of true gang graffiti is today, right now.
Basically, ditto what Mimi said. She already said it really amazingly. But also, you know, treating all graffiti as if it's the same is really actually diminishing our response to hate graffiti. So it's like, if we're focusing on removing graffiti as quickly as possible all the time, then when there's actually swastikas, when there's actually hate speech going on, then that prevents us from actually being able to address that. And, you know, a lot of property owners, like, they have insurance, businesses, they have insurance, they can take care of that stuff. It's not a huge crisis when all of a sudden some, you know, yuppie business or whatever gets graffiti painted on their building. But I think there's a lot of graffiti that is actually very artful. If people knew that their graffiti would stay up longer, maybe they'd actually, you know, put more time into it and actually make it look better, make it a mural, make it look beautiful, actually make the community better. Like, I would love to do street art with my neighbors that looks amazing and beautiful if I knew it wasn't going to be cost prohibitive to get a permit, or if I knew it wasn't going to get taken down. Also, there's a lot of graffiti that is actually really important public service announcements. It lets people know about issues in the community, like knowing about white supremacist gang symbols, knowing that Mark Kruger is a Nazi cop who hasn't been fired by the police commissioner yet, knowing that, you know, there's important things that make people feel safe. Like, if people see ACAB or FTP in their neighborhood, maybe they'll actually feel safer because they know the police aren't welcome there. And if they know, if they know that Ted Wheeler is a fascist who is supporting a fascist president and sicking riot cops on people who are peacefully protesting, then maybe they would actually feel a little bit safer in the city and feel a little bit more welcome instead of feeling like we live in a white utopia.
All right, so for the record, my name is Teresa Rayford. I'm the founder and lead organizer of a social justice organization that is called Don't Shoot Portland. Some of the concerns that I have as a citizen here and a fourth generation, going on 6th to 8th generation Oregonian, is that in my community in Northeast Portland, a couple of years ago, I think it was back in 2011, over there on Mississippi, there was graffiti that was covered up by a Portland police officer. And the news and the media and the people in that community on Mississippi Avenue were excited about using materials from the Rebuild Center to cover up graffiti. The problem is that in that community, the graffiti was placed on one of the last owned businesses from black community members. That community has been gentrified. The graffiti was hate graffiti. It included nooses. When you take those things away and people use their freedom of expression where they do, find out how you can put more money into programming to make it accessible for them. And make sure that you use the time of reporting to file hate crime investigations where you know that there is terror in our community. Thank you.
That was audio from yesterday's City Council meeting on graffiti abatement and on public behavior within City Council meetings. For full audio or video of this meeting, including testimony about City Hall behavior, go to portlandoregon.gov, or you can call up on your computer kboo.fm, search for this evening's newscast. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be cloudy, with a slight chance of rain, about 15% maybe. A high of about 57, nice and warm, a low of about 40. Today in history, in 1841, the United States Supreme Court ruled on the case of the United States versus the Amistad, finding that captured Africans who revolted on the ship en route to the Americas had been illegally enslaved. And on this day in 1945, the first nighttime incendiary bomb attack on Tokyo by the United States Army Air Force caused damage and death on a scale that was equal to, if not greater than, the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 5 months later. The quote for today is from historian and activist Howard Zinn, who said, "There's no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people for a purpose which is unattainable."
A bill before the Arkansas legislature seeks to ban any material by or about historian Howard Zinn from public or state-supported school coursework. Zinn is best known for A People's History of the United States, a book that looks at the nation's history from the perspective of marginalized and disadvantaged communities. The proposal to ban Zinn from Arkansas classrooms would be tacked onto an existing law that requires K through 12 students to stand hand on heart and recite the Pledge of the Allegiance at the start of each school day. For more on the proposed ban, Shannon Young with Free Speech Radio News spoke with Deborah Menkhart, Executive Director of Teaching for Change. She also co-directs the Zinn Education Project, which provides resources to middle and high school faculty to teach A People's History in classrooms across the country.
The bill currently before the Arkansas legislature, HB 1834, isn't the first time a local or state entity has zeroed in on Zinn's books for classroom censorship. What's the history of past bans or attempted bans?
That's correct. Some recent ones are the past 10 years was in Indiana, the governor at the time, Mitch Daniels, who's now president of Purdue University, shortly after Howard Zinn died, sent a memo to the school district and said he wanted to be assured that people's history was not going to be used in any of their public schools classrooms. That was only revealed later in a FOIA report. A journalist requested his correspondence and learned of that correspondence by Mitch Daniels. We at the time then, when that was revealed, we checked our database and found that there were close to 300 teachers in Indiana who were teaching people's history, even though Mitch Daniels said that he had been assured that people's history was not being taught in the schools. So there was a strong response and a defense of the right of teachers to teach and for students to read people's history and a number of teach-ins that were held, Zinn read-ins and teach-ins in the state. And then also in 2011, there was a ban on Mexican-American studies in Arizona with a particular focus on Tucson, where there's a very strong Mexican-American studies program. And books, a number of books, were removed from the classrooms as boxed up and removed in front of students. And one of those books was A People's History of the United States.
Much of Zinn's early work had to do with real-time coverage of the civil rights movement. And, of course, Little Rock, Arkansas was a flashpoint in that movement. What deeper significance do you see in the attempt to keep Zinn's body of work out of Arkansas classrooms in particular?
It's a good question. I'm not sure if it's anything about particularly what he wrote about Arkansas. I think there's a struggle in this country right now for the right of people to think clearly about what's going on in the world and make their own decisions, and attempt to demonize the media, attempt to demonize facts. And so I think it's the people's history that Zinn writes about allows people to see themselves in history and to realize that history is a series of choices, and it has questions about power, about who benefits and who loses from certain choices that are made in history. And that is very threatening to those that want to maintain the status quo, that would like to convey the idea that, well, all we have to do is make America great again. And, you know, if people are understanding and reading that history, they would ask exactly what period are you talking about and who was it great for? And those are the kind of critical questions that are sort of generated once people read Howard Zinn's People's History and other books that include the grassroots history of the United States.
The Zinn Education Project produces a companion book for teaching a people's history in the classroom. Is there a geographical distribution of where there's more and less interest in this particular type of teaching?
No, actually we have the companion book that we produced when the project was first launched back in 2008, and the book is still available, but also now all the lessons in that book and many, many more, with more than 100 lessons online that teachers can download for free. And what we've actually been pleased to see is that it's really teachers all over the country who have responded and are committed to ensuring that young people learn the kind of history that allows them to be informed citizens today and making informed decisions when they're voting, but also in between the elections, because obviously being an active citizen is much more than voting, but playing an active role in realizing what their responsibility as citizens is in our democracy. But no, we're seeing interest, and we've certainly seen interest over the past week from Arkansas. When we announced the Zinn Education Project, when we learned about this bill last Thursday, we realized we had a couple hundred copies here of A People's History of the United States. So we decided to make an announcement that any teacher in Arkansas who would like a copy, we'd be happy to send them a copy of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. We were pleasantly surprised by Sunday evening to have had more than 500 requests made for the book by teachers all over the state with very heartfelt reasons about their requests.
Can you go into a bit more detail about the flavor of the response that has come from Arkansas teachers?
Yeah, so I would say many of the teachers have responded in saying that they've had never read Howard Zinn's People's History, but if their state legislature wants it banned, they want to be sure that they have a copy and that they can share it with their students. Others have said, even made comments that they've heard of Howard Zinn and don't think they agree with everything he says, but they don't believe in censorship. And again, they want to make sure that there's a copy on their desk so that as students walk by, they can see that the school and their teachers defend their right to read and read from diverse perspectives. There was a teacher who mentioned going to school in Texas where her teacher, she even named him Mr. Hendricks when she was in eighth grade, introduced them to people's history, and she said it really opened her eyes, and she wants to make sure now as a first-year teacher in Arkansas that her students have that same opportunity that Mr. Hendricks afforded her. So I'd say it's quite a range, but it's an extraordinarily enthusiastic and strong response that, oh, and there's actually librarians who've also said that they're putting up displays and signs in the library saying, these are school librarians saying that here is a dangerous book or possibly censored book, banned book, and that's generating a lot of interest as well.
Deborah Minkart is co-director of the Zen Education Project. She joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
On Monday, people representing Portland's and Woodburn's immigrant communities rallied outside of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement building. KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger has the story.
Fighting for everybody. And I see everybody out here is fighting for everybody out here. Why is it that we live in Oregon, which is a sanctuary state? We live in Portland, which is a sanctuary city. We have sanctuary schools, but we still have ICE officials coming and taking members of our community. We need our elected officials to step up and create a dialogue with ICE and their agents and say, stop taking people from our community. This is a sanctuary state. Oregon is a safe place.
On Monday of this week, community organizations Millennial and Hispanic Voice for Community Change organized a rally outside of the Portland ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, building on Southwest McAdam Avenue to increase pressure on the Federal Agency of Homeland Security to leave the state of Oregon. In a show of solidarity, many community organizers and family members affected by ICE detentions in Woodburn and elsewhere in Oregon showed up to speak.
And this is a sanctuary state and a sanctuary city, and nobody's standing up. We're going to stand up, and we're going to fight.
I was able to attend the rally and spoke with Michelle Cayena Loesa, whose life stands to be completely uprooted if her father, the sole breadwinner for her family, is deported to Mexico. Michelle's father, Saul, was arrested in Woodburn a month ago while on his way to work when ICE pulled him over, purportedly in a case of mistaken identity.
We have a very special guest. We have Michelle, whose father is currently being held in detention at the Tacoma ICE Detention Center.
ICE agents pulled Saul over and asked for his brother by name. After informing the officers that his brother, whose only crime was a DUI over 10 years ago, no longer resided in the United States, he himself was taken into ICE custody and denied any opportunity to inform his family of his whereabouts. His family heard about their father's arrest only because family friends had seen Saul's vehicle pulled over on the side of the road. Saul was later transferred to a detention center in Tacoma, Washington, where he awaits legal proceedings to determine whether he will be allowed to remain in the United States. Saul has no criminal record and has been residing in the United States for over 30 years, while working to earn income and pay taxes in support of his family. What brings you here today? Here's Saul's daughter, Michelle.
Me llamo Michelle Cayena Loesa.
What brings you here today in front of the building of Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
My goal today is to support all immigrants because all that is happening here is an injustice. In my opinion, I don't believe that these deportations should be happening. Immigrants come to have a better life than they do in Mexico, and also to offer better lives to their children. They're so hardworking, and we are the future of America.
What happened to your father?
My dad was detained by immigration almost a month ago. He was driving to work, not even 5 minutes from home, when immigration stopped him and asked, "Are you so-and-so?" My dad said no. That's my brother's name, and he's in Mexico. My dad showed his driver's license to show them that he is Saul, not my uncle. But they detained him anyway, without giving him any reason as to why. My dad asked if he could make a call to me or my mom to let us see him and see about the situation. They refused. Then they brought him to City Hall and continued denying him an opportunity to make any calls. And it wasn't until I arrived here in Portland that they gave him just 3 minutes to talk to my mom, and only then could he tell her all that had happened. He was driving to his work in the morning.
In tu opinión, were they actually looking for your uncle, his brother, or were they just looking for a reason to pull him over and detain him?
Yes, it was my uncle. Yes, he has been in Mexico for the past 10 years. For me, it was an injustice, because in my opinion, immigration had no right to grab my dad, because he wasn't the one they were even looking for. But they have so much power. They're federal. But I've heard so many stories about families, like in Sandy, Oregon, where a husband was detained, and he also had no criminal record. He was clean, and he had 5 kids, a wife, and supported the family. So it's sad that these stories are out there, that they're intentionally taking the wrong people, and also that people are just out there looking for us is very sad.
I'm going to say this one in English because I don't know how to say it in Spanish. Do you think that that all of this was kind of like an excuse or like a scheme to detain your dad, or do you think they were actually looking for his brother, your uncle?
I believe that they were looking for my uncle because my uncle had a DUI and he had to show up to court, but he decided not to because probably my uncle was like, why even go to court if I'm gonna get deported? So he decided to leave to Mexico. And like my uncle, he lived with us, so they had our address.
Since then, have you been able to visit your dad in person?
The day that he was detained, we came to Portland, just before we hear that he was transferred to Tacoma. And we were there for like an hour talking with my dad. And then, it was just really sad, because my brothers thought that we all were going to be able to hug and touch him before he was transferred to Tacoma. But no, a window was dividing us instead. But when we saw this, when we saw him sitting there, it broke our hearts, and we were just crying, asking him why this was happening, and he told us the whole story. And now this moment, he's been transferred to Tacoma, and we are going to visit him this week, and hopefully, every week.
Since then, it has been really heartbreaking for my family, because my dad, he's the one that supports the family, so we're scared that if he gets deported, probably that's gonna mean that me and my family and I are gonna leave to Mexico, and we don't want that because of the violence and crime that's going on. And my brothers and I, we were born and raised here in the United States, and we want a better future than the life that my parents had in Mexico, because based on the stories that my parents told us about their life story over there, it was pretty rough, and I don't want to go through that. I want to finish my education here and be successful here in the United States. Families should not be broken apart. They should stick together, and immigrants should stay here. We are the future of this country, every Latino.
What we would like to achieve is for the mayor and the authorities to have a better communication so they're not just picking up people and deporting them and actually stop doing that and stop harming people.
Yeah.
Una movilización sin movimiento, perdón, sin estrategia no es un movimiento.
Una movilización sin estrategia no es un
movimiento. A movement without a strategy is not a movement.
Por eso les demando a ustedes también, no las demandas solo únicamente para la ciudad y para el estado. Esta es mi demanda hacia usted.
That's why we demand this for you all and the state. That's what we want.
I'm asking you, I'm demanding you to come out, to strategize, to engage, and continue proving the love you got for my community. Muchas gracias por venir. Por favor, quédense, va a haber un poco más de música y un poco más de canto. De parte de mía, entonces voy a continuar también gritando una vez más. ¡Fuera! 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 ¡Fuera!
For KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
Fuera! While women have been gaining ground in jobs traditionally held by men, in fields like medicine, law, and business, men have been taking more jobs associated with women in the so-called pink-collar sector, but not all men, according to a recent study by two Rutgers sociologists. It is those men who are already disadvantaged in the labor market, black, Hispanic, less educated, poor, and immigrant men. The gender composition of jobs is important because fields with a majority of men pay as much as 21% more than those with mostly women. The fastest growing job sectors are dominated by women, while the most rapidly diminishing ones are predominantly male. Also, men are much less likely to have moved into the higher status professions that are majority women, such as nursing and high school teaching. However, they became more male by about 2% between the years of 2000 and 2014.
After months of waiting for concrete proposals to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, the GOP unveiled its plan and began voting on the measure this week. Two influential House committees pulled all-nighters on Wednesday, ultimately moving the measure closer to a full hearing in the U.S. House of Representatives. But while lawmakers act on the proposals before them, word from the White House is that the bill is still open for negotiation and could just be the first phase of a multi-step process to reframe the nation's healthcare law. Nell Abram with Free Speech Radio News has more.
The U.S. House Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce Committees advanced the GOP repeal of the Affordable Care Act Thursday. The votes came despite widespread opposition from the healthcare industry, senior citizens, reproductive health providers, and advocates for the poor. The bill, officially called the American Healthcare Act and euphemistically called Trump Care by some, moved forward on party line votes in both committees, even though there are still no official concrete estimates of how many millions of people stand to lose their insurance plans or how much the measure will cost. The bill keeps the pre-existing condition provision of the Affordable Care Act and still allows parents to cover their children until they are 26 years old. But it would remove both the requirement that taxpayers buy health insurance and the sliding scale subsidy to help those who do purchase policies afford the premiums. Instead, the GOP-sponsored measure would charge a penalty to anyone who lets coverage lapse and then seeks to buy a new policy and provides discounts based on age, rather than financial need. Opponents say the bill will gut access to health care for many Americans and bankrupt many more. In the wee hours of the morning, Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy III took issue with one component of the bill that blocks federal funds not only from Planned Parenthood, but potentially from any hospital facility that provides abortion services.